Welcome to the MedTech Talent Lab, the number one catalyst for advancing careers and building high-performance teams. Sponsored by the Anthony Michael Group, helping companies secure in-demand talent in regulatory affairs, quality, clinical, engineering, R&D, and other areas for medical device, digital health, diagnostics, and other organizations across the U.S. life sciences sector. Here's your host, Mitch Robbins.
All right, welcome back to another episode here on the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. I am proud to be your host, Mitch Robbins, the founder and managing director here at the Anthony Michael Group, building companies and careers across MedTech and the life sciences. Look, today I'm thrilled to have this guest on the show, not only because of her expertise, but just because of her downright candor, really. And you're going to learn more about what I mean here in a minute. But today I'm proud to be hosting Miss Elena Mack, the Chief Quality Officer at SaniSure. Elena comes to the show today with an extensive background, over 25 years in quality and regulatory across pharma, biotech, and of course, medical device. She's held executive roles with companies like Olympus, BD, West Pharmaceutical Services, and the likes of Teva Pharmaceuticals, to name a few. Today at SaniSure, she is leading the team to build and maintain a best-in-class quality program. Now, if you aren't familiar with SaniSure, the company is actually a result of a merger of six different organizations. SaniSure is on a mission to be the go-to single-use technologies expert providing single-use systems and components for the bioprocessing and biomanufacturing industry. Now, the company offers a vertically integrated portfolio of proprietary solutions, custom assemblies, and engineered components. Without further ado, Elena, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
I am excited. We were screwing around offline, talking about things, and some of the things you said, I literally said, stop. That is a bite-sized clip, and I want it on the show. So we're going to dig into a variety of things. I'm so glad that you're here. I've started a lot of these episodes by really just recognizing that you are where you are today as a result of your history, but even before your professional history, it's important to understand where you came from, your formative years, et cetera. So let's start there. Where'd you grow up? What was home life like?
Well, I grew up in beautiful Rockland County, New York. And for those that are unfamiliar with that territory, it's about a half hour north of Manhattan. So beautiful suburbs of New York. Went to school in Philadelphia. My parents, just a little side note about them. My father was a New York City cop for 28 years. So he really didn't want me in the city, but allowed me to go to school in Philadelphia, which not quite sure why that was okay. My mother was a secretary, and I do have an older sister. She is 4 years older. I was always jealous that she was older. Now I'm not. And she is a pharmacist. We both went to the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science. Her major was pharmacy. Mine was originally medical technology. Until I realized the patient care piece was not my cup of tea. Waking up Miss Jones during the clinical piece, trying to get blood and she's screaming bloody murder was just not where I wanted to be. So I decided to take patient care on the other side and change my major to microbiology. So
wow. So now it's all making sense. I had no idea you grew up in New York and now the pieces are coming together. So your dad, he was a cop in New York City. Was he a cop during 9/11?
No, he retired just a few years before that, and he was very thankful for not being part of that.
I can't imagine. And you're right. How does a guy from New York City end up having their kids go to school in Philadelphia?
He really wanted me to go because my sister was there, and the idea was that my sister would watch out for me and protect me. But the reality was she had no clue what I was doing, which was really for the best. So
And you mentioned your major initially was, I think you said it was originally medical technology, correct?
Correct, yes.
So that means that you took an interest prior to that. Tell us, like, what growing up, what did hold your interest? What were you?
I love the laboratory. And, you know, you get forced to in a box of what do you want to major in? What do you want to do with your life? And you really don't have any life experience to really pull on other than I enjoyed biology lab. I liked chemistry lab. I liked being in the lab. So what the heck? You know, that seemed like an appropriate major, not really quite understanding what that was going to mean overall. So just to get everybody off my back, I'm like, okay, I'll apply to colleges that have medical technology.
Huh. And was that a rare major at the time? Because you don't see that very often, in my opinion.
Yeah. You'll see medical technician, which was a 2 years associate's. Medical technology was a small major. There weren't many people in my class.
Yeah.
There weren't many colleges that actually offered that as a major either. So it was like more specialty. I mean, now you won't find it because everything is pretty much automated and you don't need a bachelor's degree to run a machine.
Right. Right. As a kid, you know, people are either into, you know, everybody's got different hobbies. What you mentioned, your interest in the lab, and probably that developed more so in, I would imagine, high school, as far as the different biologies and chemistries that we take in high school. But what were your hobbies as a kid?
there weren't many. I mean, I collected insects outside. So I'm like, oh, you know, like I love science. My favorite creature in the world is the woolly bear. With the black and brown caterpillar that you see every fall. And funny story, my youngest daughter, her name is Sienna Isabella. And it was no mistake that Isabella is the Isabella tiger moth from the woolly bear caterpillar. So she's awesome. Like, you named me after a caterpillar, Mom. I'm like, yes.
That's awesome. Imagine her growing up and having kids. Where's your name come from, Mom? Well, it's a funny story. That's good stuff. And that's why I was digging a little bit further, because it sounds like from a very young age, science has been your thing.
Yeah, science is. I'm always curious. And, you know, watching like programs like How It's Made, like super exciting. I would love to have been on an episode, but that like really was like, how do these things happen? And in nature, you know, the parents back in the day would say, all right, go outside and play. You know, what does that look like today? It's everybody has their phones and gaming systems. But back then it was, you found your own fun.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
100%. So. I'm with you on that. Believe me. So I mentioned at the beginning during your introduction, you know, over 25 years, you've been really involved with quality and regulatory. How did you get into that space?
Well, once I graduated with my degree in microbiology, which was touch and go, you know, with, new major, new electives that I have to take, I didn't quite know what was available to me. I knew that there were laboratory jobs in R&D. And I was like, trained chimpanzee type mentality. Like, am I going to do the same thing over and over again? I was actually in luck to get a job at Wyeth, who was at the time located in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And it was a second shift position, doing environmental monitoring in the aseptic area, Thursday through Monday, second shift, best shift ever. So I remember talking to my sister and she's like, you're going to have no social life. You're working every Friday and Saturday night. Like, that's not going to work. I'm like, but it's permanent. I get benefits. I have a 401k. Like, I'm an adult and I'm making 30 grand a year. Hot dog. This is the best thing ever. And that included the shift differential. So, you know, really starting out not knowing what that involved, it actually sparked my love for everything quality and aseptic everything as well. So working alongside with manufacturing and having that hands-on experience and getting to know people and solving problems when management is long gone. So I would start at 2:30. They would be out of there by 4:30. And 4:31, that's really when the real work began. Because there was no meetings, there was no fluff. It was, okay, what do we have to get done today? Let's get it done.
Yeah. So really, what I know about you so far from this conversation and other conversations we've had is that I think you are just a driver and you really appreciate, like, let's get all the garbage out of the way and just execute. Let's get the job done. If we've got a strategy, great. Let's implement the strategy and deliver the results that we said we're going to deliver. Which brings me to my next question. I mentioned that you've had very high level positions. You've been VPs for a lot of these major corporations, Olympus, BD, et cetera. Those who listen to this show or have heard other episodes have heard me say that there's people who aspire to be a high-level executive, and there's people who make it happen. And a lot of times your pedigree can be fairly similar, but there's those who get those positions and those that don't. After all, there's only so many that can go around. I want you, if you would, please, Forrest, talk about moments in your career that you really help, that you really feel helped catalyze your ability to get there.
So what do they say? You know, if you could dream it, you could achieve it, right? And there was one experience that I had when I was at a company called Accupack. They are a contract manufacturer, creams, lotions, ointments, semi-solids, and they were family-owned and moved to private equity. So it kind of sounds like where I'm at in Santa Shore. And I was brought in as a manager of regulatory compliance coming from GSK, which, by the way, love GSK. Too bad they didn't have a manager job for me. So I had to leave. But coming into Accupack, I'm like, wow, this is a treasure trove of opportunity. They don't really have robust systems. They were family run. There was no money. They didn't want to spend money. So I was there to really redevelop their compliance program. About 2 months into my stay at Accupack, the VP resigned. He went off to Medtronic out on the West Coast, and we didn't have a leader. And I remember all of the managers and the one director, we all got together like, who are they going to bring in? Who do we know that could fill this role? It's a really critical role. 100% customer facing. We had no private label products. So it was sink or swim. If we don't have customers, we don't have a business. The CEO calls me into his office, and here I am. I always think, I'm like, oh man, I'm getting fired. I've only been here for 2 months. And he said, Elena, I really like your initiative. I like your energy. And I think you could do great things here. I'm like, oh, thank you, Paul. I appreciate it. And then he says, what do you think about accepting a role as a director level and having QA and QC and regulatory report into you? And, you know, the look on my face must have been priceless because I didn't have any management experience. I came from QC. I had QA. I had some regulatory. So I'm like, I would love to. It would be a great opportunity. So we agreed. Announcement was going to go out. I left the office in disbelief. And I'm like, what did I just do? Can I do this? And I'm like, of course I could do it. Why? You know, I will learn. I will ask questions. I will figure it out. And I think by really having that mentality of like, no fear, like I'll figure it out. And the first day of the job, I sat at my desk. I'll never forget it because I'm like, I'm going to wait for the work to come to me. I'm going to stare at my email screen and it's all going to kind of roll in and we're just going to take it from there. And that's exactly how I started. And the interesting part, they gave it to me as a director level because if things didn't work out, they didn't want to demote me. And that would have been a really huge stretch from a manager to a VP. And I was given an ask. There was a very large customer, actually our number one customer, that was threatening to leave because the quality was terrible on so many different levels. And I was told, you better fix it. This is your one job, right? So I met with the customer and all of their leadership. And this one individual said, what makes us think that you're the answer? What, did you just graduate high school? It's like, it must be my La Mer keeping me young and sunscreen. And I said, no, I will do this. And I did. And not only did they stay, but they increased their volume. We had new product launches. And in between there, I was promoted to VP before the age of 30. And I was like, that's a win.
It's a huge win. And there's so much to unpack there. Let me go back. So when you joined the company and you got brought into the CEO's office, at that point, you were a manager for about 2 months or so?
Correct.
What gave you that fearless attitude at the time? Where does that come from?
Quite frankly, it comes from my dad. I mean, you know, I'll censor the language, but he's like, you know, just make it happen. Do it. Like, if others can do it, why can't you?
Is that how you were raised, you're saying?
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Because I can imagine the different emotions going on in your mind when you were brought in thinking, on one hand, you thought you were walking into getting fired a couple months.
I'm always negative, like, oh no, what did I do?
And then you find out, hey, I'm actually being offered to be promoted. But then, like, oh my gosh, what does this mean? It's a lot of responsibility. The team's going to look dead to me. I'm pretty young, as you mentioned. You even got comments, and you're like, going to do it anyways. And I will tell you with absolute certainty, people get tired. I hope people don't get tired of this because it's such a point that needs to be hammered home. With absolute 1,000% certainty, every single leader I have interviewed on this show and in previous life has said, the catalyst for my career has been taking risk and putting myself out there and being comfortable with being uncomfortable and doing it anyways. And here you are sharing the similar story. So it's one thing to be fearless. It's another thing to get out and actually deliver, right?
Yeah.
If you look back to those early moments, especially when you were in a position where you really had to gain the trust of the team pretty quickly, especially with comments that you said were being made, what can you say about how you were able to execute and deliver? What, anything around like why you think it came together?
Because I was on the floor with them. It wasn't like, okay, guys, we need to do better. We need to improve. Okay, I'm going to go back in my office and you let me know what you come up with and make sure it's done by next week. Hey. And that has never been my, what do they call it? Like leadership language, for lack of a better term. And I never responded well to that as an incumbent. Like, okay, just do it. Okay, well, if you're not going to give me any direction and you're not going to do it with me, what motivation do I have to get this done?
Yeah.
I'm going to collect the paycheck no matter how you slice it, unless I get canned. But, you know, what's really going to inspire me to stay over 8 hours, to really focus, to really, you know, drive within my colleagues to get things done? And I was in scrubs, no makeup, ponytail, awesome. If I can only do that every day. And actually, I do that at Santa Shore too. I go into the clean room. I will never forget where I came from. I've been on the manufacturing floor since the beginning of my career. And for every position I've held, I always go to the plants. Like, I always want to be near or in a plant. That's where the action happens.
So I appreciate that because I'm sure that drives a ton of respect and trust and credibility. Let me talk about the flip side of that. And that is that usually newer managers are very good individual contributors. Historically, management will say, that person's a rock star. They need to be our manager. Let's promote them. The person gets into the position, like, they're awful managers. They can't delegate. They're micromanagers. They hover over. They want to do everything themselves. How did you find a balance to figure out, okay, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be with them. I'm going to show them I'm right by their side doing something similar. But how did you get also start to understand how to delegate as well and realize that it's not necessarily your job to do their job. It's your job to make sure the job gets done.
So the delegation part is a challenging one for me because I will say, okay, Susie, you know, let me show you what I'm looking for and I'll start them and then send them on their way. And then, okay, you know, there's time points that we'll check for deliverables and move on. And then, okay, the next one. In the beginning, I'm like, I had to put together that strategy and that plan. And from a prioritization perspective, if everything's a priority, nothing's a priority. And okay, we're going to divide and conquer. And what I have found, if I don't surround myself with capable people, then I'll never be successful. And I told them, I will never be successful alone. If you guys are successful, that's when I'm successful. So there's, and if you fail, I fail. We're all in this together. It's sink or swim. So really making sure that that's widely communicated. It's not like, oh, Elena will sit in her office and take all the credit. That's not how it works. I made that very clear.
I think I missed the part when you said delegation's tough for me. Clarify that.
It is because a lot of things I can do myself. I have done myself. So, you know, trusting Susie, I love to use that name for a person. Trusting Susie is challenging, but it's like I don't have 24 hours to work.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
Somebody, one of my past bosses always used to tell me, you know, Elena, there's 24 hours in a day. And I'm like, yeah, thanks, pal. But yeah, it's, you know, understanding, you know, how much bandwidth you have to be effective. And I can't be effective if I'm just putting my head down and just executing things that my team can.
That comment that your old boss made is very similar to a comment one of my old bosses made, which would be pointing out when a competitor was actually working with a client I was trying to get. Oh, I saw so-and-so is working with that client. It's like, oh, you really, really? And I'm sticking with this delegation topic for a minute, because you're running major organizations as an executive and you can't get anywhere without delegation. And I think as I think through the conversations I've had and what I know about people being promoted and running companies, that a lot of people cap out at the director level, maybe senior director, right? And then there's very, very few people who become vice presidents, real vice presidents, meaning like it's not just a title in a company of three people, like it's an actual corporate executive position. And I think delegation is probably one of those huge pieces, because if you got a few direct reports and they've got a couple, you know, potentially a couple hundred direct reports, you have to have a tremendous amount of trust in your people.
Yes. And some of those people you can select, some of them you cannot.
Yeah.
So typically coming into a VP level job, you have your team already selected for you. And what I have a challenge with is like, well, Susie, yeah, we've had problems with her for years for performance, but we never dealt with it. And, you know, so-and-so, yeah, they're okay, but, you know, they're not lighting the world on fire. And it's like you have subpar performers that have never been coached, have never been on a performance management plan. And at their end of the year review, it's meets expectations, you know, oh, they're steady Eddie, you know, we'll hold on to them. And not saying, don't you want the eight players on your team? But people in positions past didn't manage their team. And their focus was apparently elsewhere. So it becomes challenging stepping into the role, being successful when you don't have capable people to surround yourself with.
And what a great point you brought up, because that's what can lead a really high-performing leader back to trying to do things themselves to keep the ball rolling versus dealing with the systemic issue. And I think also it's a note for executives who are listening to this show right now, the importance of empowering your middle management and your other executives to really make sound decisions that line up with your values. If you say human capital is our most important asset, or we can't get anywhere without our human capital, but you're dealing with subpar performance because it's easier to do it that way than to deal with the conflict or to deal with the performance improvement plans and, you know, managing them out and all that stuff, well, then are you really living up to what your mission and your values say? I don't think so. And it happens more often than we all realize. Elena, I'm so happy you're here, because this is an awesome conversation. You're dropping a ton of gold. One of my purposes is to help the industry realize, I think people realize the importance of regulatory and quality, but I don't think by any means do these functions have the respect they deserve, both from a functional perspective as well as a people perspective. And I think so often it's like, people can say, man, we need the regulatory strategy to get our products to market. We need quality because otherwise we're in big trouble, right? And we got to protect patients. But it's almost like a necessary, you said an analogy that I thought was just brilliant. And I want you to talk about it, and I'll give you a reference so that you know what I'm talking about, but the party, basically. And so let me set the stage, right? It's like the company's having a party and in walks quality. Take it from there, if you would, because it's so important.
So the analogy of like Debbie Downer, like, quality is here. Preventer of progress. You know, quality is not invited to the party until something goes wrong. And, you know, we hear the tagline time and time again, wherever you go, you see it all over LinkedIn, commitment to quality, commitment to this, commitment to patient. But when it comes to financial investment in people and programs, we fall short. And in times of financial struggle, that's the first thing that goes. And, you know, really understanding what the purpose is. Now, I will always joke with my manufacturing brethren, which I have the utmost respect for. And I said, you know, there was one discussion I had. you know, we want to eliminate this in-process inspection. So it's taking three operators, you know, the downtime to get the results before we move on. You know, if we cut these people, you know, we'll save all this money and time. And I said, that's great. I said, you can cut my whole department. When you have everything 100% automated and perfect and don't have any errors, I'm overhead. You know, you can eliminate my entire department, but that's not the process that we have. So we have a manual process and we need those people. And, you know, it's like, haha, like, oh, you want the biggest cost savings? Take us all out. But, you know, we're usually there when things go sideways and that there's a problem. And we are crisis managers. And I think quality and regulatory people are of a different breed entirely. You have to have a certain type of personality that you could pivot very quickly. Like you could be going along your day, going through meetings, you know, mini crises here and there. And then all of a sudden you get the IM and like there's an emergency meeting and it's like, here we go. All right. Yep. I got to put these things on the back burner. I need to focus on there. But yeah, it's usually fast and furious.
Well, and then you read about these recalls in the 483 letters and all this stuff that probably in theory could have been, should have been prevented. But then what do you know? Millions of dollars spent on consulting firms. We got to fix this right now. Fix it, fix it, fix it. We can't even manufacture products anymore, our sales. But yet that I'm not naming any company names, but I've seen it where it's like the mentality at the very top was sales first, sales first, sales first. But then, like you said, you go to the website, is quality is the utmost importance, patient safety, yada, yada, yada. What do you think? I mean, you've been in this industry longer than I have. Why, where is this, it's almost like, what's the word I'm looking for? Where you say two things and they don't make sense together. I'm at a loss for words right now. You know what I'm saying, though.
No, I completely understand. And I'm one of those people.
Oxymoron.
Yes. I'm one of those people that look forward to the FDA email of the weekly warning letter updates, because as I look at them, and it's like, oh, this was preventable. How did this happen? And I think of my own experience of near misses and signals that were communicated to management, or, you know, you have management reviews and many SOPs just want to check the box of what you're looking at. And they happen once, maybe twice a year. And whatever signals you see, you know, are well-aged and they're not actionable necessarily at that time. So you kind of see that, but you don't want to be overburdened by meetings and slide decks and all that. It's like, how about new you can use? I love that. And I use that phrase. I've used it for over 25 years.
It cut out. Say the phrase one more time.
News you can use.
News you can use.
And it's like, hey guys, we had a near miss. It wasn't a nonconformance. It wasn't a deviation. Somebody caught it, thankfully. Thank you, Susie, on the floor. Thank you, QC. Thank you for speaking up. And oh my God, how did that potentially happen? What do we need to do to make sure that never happens again? And everybody gets together and they fix it instead of saying, not my job, not my problem. And that's the culture of quality that, you know, you'll hear that phrase everywhere. What's the quality culture like? You know, what programs do you have in place besides Quality Month in November? Like, and all these fun bingo activities around quality terms, regulatory terms, like super fun, love it. But yeah. You know, what are you doing every day and how are you prioritizing quality?
As if this wasn't frustrating enough to kind of voice and let out, what's the toughest part? What would you say is the toughest part about being a quality executive?
Ensuring that everybody truly recognizes that quality is everyone's responsibility. I think first and foremost, like it's a tagline. You see it in your first day of GMP training, you know, quality. What does that mean to you, Susie, on the floor? Like, Susie, do you understand what you do? And it's not, you know, I put parts together, you know, I clean the line, I clean the floor. Do you understand that there's a patient attached to that component? And, you know, a little personal story. When my son, Gabriel, was age 7, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. and completely destroyed my world. And in some ways destroyed my marriage as well, because I was super anxious all the time. Is there a particulate in his insulin? Does this pen work correctly? Is this alcohol swab recalled for bacterial contamination? Like, this is where my head goes as a quality professional of, hey, I wonder who the quality manager is at, you know, this company for his, you know, he's gone to an insulin pump. Should I let him out of the house? Like, all of these things. And every day that I went to work kind of put my work in perspective. If I'm having an off day, somebody could be impacted by that. That somebody could be myself. It could be a family member. It could be a friend. It could be a coworker. It could be anyone. But it's a person. There's a person on the, we're not making widgets. We're making medical devices. We're making drug products. And we need to kind of keep that in perspective of why we go to work every day. So when I do a presentation, I'll ask the crowd, why are you here today? And if anybody says, I'm here for a paycheck, I tell them they need to find another job. They don't understand their why. And that's the why. We'll get the longevity in your career. That's what has kept me well engaged for over 25 years, is the why. And my son is now 25. So he's gone through some ups and downs and some challenging situations. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm making sure for whatever products that I support, I remember the patient. So
it's a touching story in a couple fronts. One, the personal piece of what you just shared. But two, I feel like there are a lot of people in our industry who have personal ties to why they do what they do. And they take it to work with them every day. And I think they put themselves in the shoes of who the end user is, who the patients are that they are serving. And you're right. There's a distinct difference between somebody like yourself, who literally is tied to this and understands what it's like to have quality affecting a actual family member, versus somebody who comes to work who's not necessarily tied to that piece of it, but is a quality person because that's their profession. That there really is a difference. And I think that goes for any job. Is like, if you, and it comes back to exactly what you said, the Simon Sinek thing. What's your why? Like, and can, do you actually feel it viscerally? Right. And for you, clearly you do. For the sake of time, I want to get to a couple other things here. And that is, you didn't get to where you're at by yourself. As talented and as cool as you are, you obviously didn't get to where you are on your own. And none of us have. If you would talk about mentorship and talk about kind of the journey of maybe who's helped you and how.
I give all credit to my cat. So it's interesting, you know, they always say you base your success on who you surround yourself with, not only on a work level, but a personal level. Yeah. And, you know, I can say from don't cry now, Mitch, this is not a sad story. From a personal level, throughout my career, it hasn't been easy. And, you know, going through a divorce, then having two small kids, going through that, but yet still trying to keep looking forward, and it's challenging. My sister has been my rock, and, you know, really has guided me. I didn't have a whole lot of mentors. Like, I've worked in companies that have these mentor programs, and I thought they were all fluff. Like, I had real questions. Like, what should I do next? What's out there? I mean, if I could give advice to any quality professional starting out, in the first 5 years, go to FDA. That will be the best move of your life, to get that experience on the ground fast and furious and be immersed in what the other side looks like as well. And you could take that to any company and make improvements. Nobody told me really anything of, yeah, you could go from the lab, you could go to... to QA, regulatory. I went to regulatory and it was the worst 3 months of my life. They called it the summer of Elena because everybody said it was great in my master's program. And I'm like, there's no action, there's no manufacturing. So like from a boss standpoint, some of them taught me how I didn't want to be. And, you know, making time for my team all levels of my team, not just my direct reports, but my indirects as well. You know, they always say, wait, what is it? Chain of command. I don't believe in that. My door is open. If Susie on the manufacturing floor wants to talk about something or has a concern, she should be able and comfortable to be able to talk to me. And I do have a meeting up and coming for ASQ, which is Undercover Boss. And it was when I was a interim quality manager at a site, and they didn't know that I was from corporate. And I didn't want them to know that I wasn't acting as corporate. I was acting as their quality manager because somebody left. So, you know, to be treated a different way when they found out I was corporate, and they're like, we can't treat you like that. You're one of us. And I'm like, I will always be one of you. So coming soon.
That is awesome. You actually lived the show Undercover Boss. That is so cool.
They were pissed when they found out. They're like, why didn't you tell us you were from corporate? I'm like, it wasn't important. You know that I have a farm. I have like 5 million animals. You know, that's what I love to hike. Like, that's what you needed to know.
I can't imagine too. Sometimes, like, I've watched the show many times. I get a kick out of it, but I can't imagine the embarrassment and the kind of the feeling that those people feel when they find out who is there. So, but at the same time, there's no better way to find out what the heck is going on in your business versus living it day to day. I got to back up though, because you said a lot of things. You said, hey, I've learned from some bosses what not to do. And that taught me really who I want to be as a leader. You mentioned that your advice to newer quality folks is to try and get FDA experience. I want to touch on that specifically. You think it's valuable to perhaps go to FDA if they could and learn that side before you step into quality and manufacturing?
I would say in the first 5 years, like, get some background what manufacturing is about before you jump into their training program, and not, you know, just like fresh out of college, see if you can get into the agency. But it's more of, you know, get 1 to 3 years in. You have the landscape, you have some understanding of GMP.
Yeah.
And then start applying for field positions.
Interesting. That piece makes sense. As far as the mentorship for you, it doesn't sound like you necessarily sought out like formal mentorship, but they always say it's lonely at the top, right? And I talked about BD, I talked about Olympus. Before you came to Sanisure, you were VP at Olympus. You can rely on internal colleagues, but sometimes it's nice to talk to folks who might understand your pains and your win, or want to celebrate your wins. Have you been one to kind of communicate with peers in different organizations for advice as well, or how have you managed that piece?
Yeah, the peer-to-peer relationships are strong. I mean, I've talked to people all the way back in my microbiology days when I was in the QC lab, and it's a network that I continue to foster. And, you know, from a mentoring perspective, many of my previous direct reports and indirect reports asked if I'll be their mentor. And some of them I've hired again, and I will hire them again at some point in the future. Like, you know, you take that developed talent with you. You know what they're capable of. You know where they need to develop further. And, you know what passion they have. So, yeah, it goes both ways. It's the peer-to-peer. Whether they're in quality operations, I keep in touch with my operations brethren as well. Like, hey, you know, what would you do in this situation? You know, kind of stuck. I'm not quite sure where to take this. I want to hear it from a different point of view.
Yep. On this show, I talk a lot about rising up the ranks, right? I bring on leaders who have they've made it, so to speak, and they give back. Kind of in hindsight, hey, if I was to do it again, here's what I would do differently, et cetera. What I haven't talked about much is quality engineering. And you've managed a variety of quality engineers over time. What makes an outstanding quality engineer different from an average quality engineer?
One that can clearly explain statistics to me. that like, if you can have me understand, so just as a background, I use Minitab circa 1992. I never want to touch it again. And that's why I have quality engineers that will help me understand the data. but not one that's just kind of like buried into the keyboard and here's some charts, here's some graphs, you know, here's a brief summary. Like, help me understand, what are we seeing here? But they're usually not very, I want to say, clear and concise. Like, teach me, help me understand. Usually, like I said, it's an email with the data and it's like, okay, that's great. That's what I was looking for. But, you know, please help me understand.
Really, really great response, because a lot of times when I talk to CEOs of companies even, or yeah, for the most part, CEOs, regulatory and quality can get very buried into what they know best, which, and it's very technical. And the ability to communicate that in layman's terms is, what does it mean for the business? What is the action item that we need to take as a business in order to move forward with our initiatives or protect our assets is critical. And so what you basically are just articulating is like, hey, even within quality, like, there's people who haven't touched the technical piece for a while. Can you actually communicate to me what I need to know so I can make a decision for our function and then report to my boss of what is going on with our programs? That makes a lot of sense. This has been amazing. It really has. I am so grateful I had you on the show, and I give you a huge kudos to what you've done with your career so far. I want to wrap up by asking you, what are you excited about, what's going on with SaniSure right now? Where are you guys headed?
Well, I was so happy to be able to join SaniSure in July of last year and really seeing the vision. And the CEO that is in place, Stephen, is amazing. And he is everything that I wanted a boss to be. Hopefully he watches this podcast, and he stays to the end.
I'll make sure.
But now, to have a leader with passion, direction is just amazing. And for SaniSure as a whole, we do have aspirations, but we have actions to back that up. So that's super exciting. From a quality perspective, we are moving from ISO 9001 to ISO 13485. As you know, as the intro stated, you know, trying to have that world-class quality system to be able to serve our customers and really understanding the environment and the regulatory requirements that our customers have, they want their suppliers to have the same. Mm-hmm. Or at least similar. So, you know, garbage in, garbage out, right? If you don't have a supplier with a robust quality system and operating system, the material that you're putting into your valuable drug products may fail. And that would be a very costly mistake from time and money. So.
Awesome. Well, if it's cool with you, what we're going to do on the show notes is we'll put a link to your LinkedIn profile, encourage anybody who would like to reach out to you directly. And then we'll also put a link to SaniSure's website for those who want to check out more.
Perfect.
All right. Well, I can't thank you enough for being here. It was an amazing show. And we certainly wish you guys, you personally and the organization, all the best moving forward.
That's great. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thanks for listening to the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. For more content-rich episodes, log on to theanthonymichaelgroup.com or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform.